a very good day.
Good morning, Africa. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. has hit 500,000 COVID-19 deaths.
We have to resist becoming numb to the sorrow.
Also ahead, after months of denial, Tanzania's president appears to acknowledge COVID-19 exists in his country.
Tanzania has refused to track coronavirus cases, so there are no figures on how many people have fallen ill or died from the virus.
Plus, Italy's ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo is killed in an ambush. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., which has passed 500,000 recorded deaths from COVID-19. It's the highest death toll in the world, in the country with the largest outbreak of the virus, with over 28 million confirmed cases. On Monday evening, President Joe Biden held a candle lighting ceremony and a moment of silence to memorialize the dead.
Each day, I receive a small card in my pocket that I carry with me in my schedule. It shows the number of Americans who have been infected by or died from COVID-19. Today, we mark a truly grim, heartbreaking milestone. 500,071 dead. That's more Americans who have died in 1 year in this pandemic than in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. That's more lives lost to this virus than any other nation on earth.
Biden called on Americans to not let the death count become mere statistics, but to remember the individuals behind the numbers.
The people we lost were extraordinary. They spanned generations. Born in America, immigrated to America. But just like that, so many of them took their final breath alone in America. As a nation, we can't accept such a cruel fate. While we've been fighting this pandemic for so long, we have to resist becoming numb to the sorrow.
Biden closed his speech by urging people to follow public health advice to stop the disease.
So today, I ask all Americans to remember. Remember those we lost and those who left behind. But as we all remember, I also ask us to act, to remain vigilant, to stay socially distanced, to mask up, get vaccinated when it's your turn. We must end the politics and misinformation that's divided families, communities, and the country. And it's cost too many lives already.
Earlier Monday, the country's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, also reflected on the moment.
And now we have a situation where we've reached a landmark that is stunning in its magnitude. This is the worst thing that's happened to this country with regard to the health of the nation in over 100 years. You know, and people 20, 30, 40, 50, maybe even 100 years from now are going to be talking about this. About that horrible year of 2020 and maybe into 2021, you know? I mean, that's the point.
While the United States has just about 4% of the global population, it has recorded nearly 20% of all COVID-19 deaths. Fauci, who has worked for six presidents, including Trump and Biden, said a country as wealthy and sophisticated as the U.S. should not have had such a high toll. He said political divisiveness contributed to the massive death count.
I try to analyze what the most compelling reason why we've done worse than we should have done. And I don't know if this is true, but it feels this way to me as a public health person. that if ever you did not want to have an outbreak of any sort in a certain condition, it would be in a condition where there was intense divisiveness in society, which is what we have. That I don't think it's, you know, all Donald Trump or all this or all that. It's a combination of things. And certainly the lack of involvement at the very, very top of the leadership.
The World Health Organization reports over 111 million confirmed COVID-19 cases worldwide, with over 2.4 million deaths. In Tanzania, President John Magufuli has claimed for months that the coronavirus was defeated in his country through prayer and steam treatments. His government has stopped reporting COVID-19 data to the World Health Organization and has not implemented WHO-recommended public health measures. But after a number of recent high-profile deaths linked to the virus, Magufuli now appears to be acknowledging that there is a problem of COVID-19 in Tanzania. While not specifically naming the virus, Magufuli over the weekend urged Tanzanians to begin wearing face masks for respiratory illnesses that are becoming a problem. Charles Kombe has more from Dar es Salaam.
It is almost a year since Tanzania President John Magufuli declared his country to be free from COVID-19 and said prayer helped to defeat the virus. But on Sunday church mass in the capital Dodoma, Magufuli urged citizens to take precautions, including traditional remedies and wear face masks, but only locally made ones.
Sisi tuchukue tahadhari za kiafya.
We should take health precautions, as it was announced, Magufuli says. He said we should put God first while searching for an alternative in line with steam inhalation. He said that his own children got sick, some of his little ones got sick, and they recovered. It's all about putting God first, he said, adding that steam inhalation should not be ignored. At the end of last week, Magufuli called on Tanzanians for 3 days of prayer to defeat unnamed respiratory diseases amid warning from the Catholic Church, the U.S. Embassy, and others that Tanzania has seen a deadly resurgence in coronavirus infections. Tanzanians such as Baraka Kila found President's remarks unsettling.
Mwanzoni ni kama tulikuwa tunajiaminisha kwamba kweli huenda ikawa haipo kwa sababu tukiangalia kwenye
Kila says at first they were convinced that it really did not exist. But looking at social networks like Twitter and Facebook, various people were posting about death caused by a coronavirus, and it was causing a lot of controversies, and the government disagreed. To a large extent, he says we must continue to believe that some of the death that occurred were caused by COVID-19. We are scared because when the president admits the existence of coronavirus, it means it has spread a lot, as killer. Rachel Nzengo, a student at the University of Dar es Salaam, says the move will awaken those who are not taking the virus seriously in Tanzania. After the president spoke, she thinks Tanzanians will start to protect themselves. She says that people have been squeezing into community buses without taking precautions. Nzengo asked that she thinks it's a good thing that yesterday Magufuli talked. People will start to protect themselves because we see people dying every day, and they say that there's no disease. Magufuli spoke after the death of the vice president of Zanzibar region, Saif Sharif Hamad. Hamad's death drew widespread attention after his party said he had died of COVID-19. Tanzania has refused to track coronavirus cases, so there are no figures on how many people have fallen ill or died from the virus. However, other East African countries have experienced thousands of cases, and there's no reason to think Tanzania has been spared. The president's speech may change people's perceptions and prompt doubters of COVID-19 to take serious precautions for the first time. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Two UK studies released Monday show that COVID-19 vaccination programs are contributing to a sharp drop in hospitalizations, boosting hopes that the shots will work as well in the real world as they have in carefully controlled studies. Preliminary results from a study in Scotland found that the Pfizer vaccine reduced hospital admissions by up to 85% 4 weeks after the first dose, while the AstraZeneca shot cut admissions by up to 94%. In England, preliminary data from a study of healthcare workers showed that the Pfizer vaccine reduced the risk of catching COVID-19 by 70% after one dose, a figure that rose to 85% after the second. Despite the evidence in favor of COVID-19 vaccines, people the world over have questions about their safety. Some are reluctant to get immunized. In order to get you the best information possible, VOA's health correspondent Carol Pearson helps debunk some common myths about these new vaccines.
Scientists around the world have rushed to find a vaccine to protect against the virus that's caused the COVID-19 pandemic. The virus has claimed more than 2 million lives and infected more than 100 million people. Yet despite the proven protection that COVID vaccines offer, people still have doubts about getting one.
I don't know what to believe, to either believe the news, believe social media, believe whatever is out there, you know?
I'm a little bit skeptical because I want to know, how is it going to affect my immune system?
I don't see why I would take a vaccine for something that I may not ever get.
The skepticism is just as real in sprawling cities like Los Angeles and in the small towns of West Virginia.
The bad part about it is, if it goes wrong and you do get a virus from it, then what?
Some vaccines are made from weakened or dead viruses, but experts say there's no need to worry. Dr. Tosin Goji of the Cleveland Clinic was trained in infectious diseases.
No, it's not going to give you COVID. It's not a live vaccine. You're not going to get a COVID infection.
Although the vaccines are new, Dr. Goji says the technology used to make them is not.
It was initially put together for cancer patients. So it's not like we just found this technology within the past year for COVID. It's something that has been in place. And when the opportunity came, it was like an aha moment, like we can use this technology for this.
The World Health Organization has a web page that addresses the myths and concerns about the vaccines and the virus itself, including who can get COVID-19. The answer, everyone. Can certain foods like garlic protect against COVID? What about dietary supplements or vitamins? The World Health Organization says there's no evidence they can. And then there's a belief that these vaccines can change your genetic code.
It will destroy your DNA and you'll become part of like a transhuman because they're putting nanoparticles into it.
The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are mRNA vaccines or messenger RNA vaccines. Remember the spike protein on the COVID virus? These vaccines teach our cells how to make a protein or even a piece of a protein that triggers an immune response inside our bodies. Dr. Tosin Goji says these fears are not warranted.
It's not changing your DNA. People think, oh, it's going to change me. And that's why I take the pictures. It's not integrating itself into your DNA. No, it's not changing who you are.
The World Health Organization is calling for massive public education campaigns to address people's concerns and their fears. Experts say vaccines, along with prevention efforts, keeping hands clean, wearing masks and social distancing will put an end to the pandemic, but only if people follow these practices. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
While the world focuses on COVID-19, the Ebola virus has reappeared. New cases have been confirmed this month in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Guinea. However, unlike the early days of COVID-19, there is already an effective Ebola vaccine that so far has helped contain outbreaks where they occur. To find out more about the development of the Ebola vaccine and its effectiveness and how it is used, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Columbia University epidemiologist Tiffany Harris in New York.
The one that they tried in Guinea seemed to prove effective. That trial showed around 75% effectiveness.
And that trial-tested vaccine served a dual purpose during the 2014-2015 outbreak, didn't it?
Right. They were able to do a study sort of in the midst of the outbreak as a way to try to study this vaccine, but also control the outbreak.
How was it used?
They vaccinated rings around people identified as cases, and they vaccinated this initial ring of contacts of those cases and then the contacts of those contacts.
And to scientifically prove efficacy?
They randomized the clusters to either immediate vaccination or delayed vaccination, and those in the delayed vaccination group got vaccinated 21 days later.
So one might ask, why didn't they just vaccinate the whole country at that point?
There is a supply issue. We're seeing that now with COVID. They also needed to study it. So if you just give everyone the vaccine, if the disease goes away, you don't know, was it because of your vaccine? Or maybe it just would have gone away for other reasons. And so you need to do some kind of trial where you have your intervention group and your control group.
So the Ebola vaccine was 75% effective then. How effective is the vaccine that we have nowadays?
There's varying data, but it seems that maybe the effectiveness is closer to 100%. It's an effective vaccine. One of the things the WHO is studying, though, is people who got vaccinated as part of previous outbreak, are they now cases in the new outbreak? They need to understand whether a booster might be needed or revaccination if there's another outbreak or if you get lifelong protection. But right now, with the Ebola vaccine, the plan is to do this targeted vaccine approach in response to outbreak.
Okay, so it won't be an automatic vaccination for all children and travelers like the way it is for yellow fever vaccines, for example.
That's not the plan right now. Yellow fever vaccine, for example, for travelers is only required for travel to certain countries where there's yellow fever. And the thing that's different also is yellow fever is a vector-borne disease spread by mosquitoes, and it's exposure to a geographic area, whereas Ebola is only spread from person to person. And so you can use this ring approach where you really just focus on vaccinating those who have potential exposure to a case. Sometimes what you can do also is vaccinate a specific geographic area, maybe like a whole village, if it's very difficult to identify specific people as contact.
But now that they have nearly 100% effectiveness, why do they continue to vaccinate people in these concentric rings emanating from positive cases? At this point, why not just go the whole way and vaccinate everyone?
Good question, and the answer is multifold. Vaccines have expiration dates, and so with Ebola, we haven't seen widespread Ebola outbreak across the whole globe. So there's not really the impetus to mass manufacture vaccines. The WHO is working to create a stockpile that can be used for an outbreak, but it's not like COVID, which has swept the globe, or flu, which is seen globally, measles, mumps, things along those lines. And it is a resource issue at the end of the day, right? So if you're spending money manufacturing vaccine and getting into the arms of every person in a given country, that's money that's not being spent on something else that's way more common, like measles vaccine or even other non-health related issues.
That was Columbia University epidemiologist Tiffany Harris speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. This is VOA. Aircraft manufacturer Boeing has recommended that airlines ground all model 777s with the type of engine that blew apart after takeoff from Denver in the U.S. this weekend. Most carriers, including United, that fly the 777 planes with Pratt & Whitney PW4000 engines, say they will temporarily pull them from service. In a significant defeat for former President Donald Trump, the Supreme Court of the U.S. has declined to step in to halt the turnover of his tax records to a New York state prosecutor. Its action is a blow to Trump because he has long fought to keep his tax records shielded. He has called the probe a, quote, fishing expedition, end quote, witch hunt, end quote. Listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Italy's ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo and two others were killed Monday in an attempted kidnapping targeting a UN convoy in the east of the country. David Doyle of Reuters reports.
Italy's ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo, his bodyguard and a driver have been killed in an attack on a UN convoy in DRC's east, the Italian Foreign Ministry and local authorities have said. Ambassador Luca Attanasio, military policeman Vittorio Iacovacci, and the Congolese driver, whose name has not been released, were traveling with the UN's Organization Stabilization Mission in DRC, known as MONUSCO, on Monday morning, when they were targeted by unknown assailants. Authorities from the Virunga National Park said the attack took place near the town of Kanyamahoro, a few miles north of the regional capital Goma, and was an attempted kidnapping. Virunga stretches north from near Goma along DRC's border with Rwanda and Uganda. Dozens of armed groups operate in the area, and park rangers have been repeatedly targeted, including six who were killed in an ambush last month. Italy's Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio expressed his great shock and immense sorrow. He was in Brussels for a European Union meeting when he heard the news and cut short his visit to head back to Italy. Attanasio was head of Italy's mission in DRC since 2017 and became ambassador in 2019. He was married and had three young daughters, according to his Facebook page.
That was David Doyle of Reuters. Ugandan opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi, better known by his stage name Bobi Wine, says he will withdraw his petition at the Supreme Court challenging January's re-election of President Yoweri Museveni. Wine alleged bias in the court toward Museveni, who has ruled Uganda since 1986. The opposition leader says his side has not been allowed to present evidence of fraud in the vote. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
In announcing his decision Monday, Wine said authorities had blocked his attempt to present a case, citing the police lockdown of his party offices and the military denying access to his lawyers and officials of his National Unity Platform Party. He also accused the Supreme Court of rejecting as many as 200 affidavits. Wine said this is a sign the judiciary does not intend to serve justice in the matter, and they would not participate in what he called mockery to justice.
The Supreme Court said we could only submit in this our petition for 30 minutes. Now that was clear. One, the Supreme Court did not want this matter to attract so much attention. So for that matter, for the reasons that we've given above, we have decided to withdraw from their court. The courts are not independent. It is clear that these people are working for Mr. Museveni.
Through his lawyers, Wine filed the petition February 1st, seeking to nullify the election that saw President Museveni win a sixth term with 58% of the votes. They also asked the court to ensure that Museveni can never run again in an election, accusing him of orchestrating violence, using soldiers to pre-tick ballots and invade polling stations. Jameson Karemani, the court registrar, says the court is not bothered by Wine's allegations of favoritism. He says once the court receives the application to withdraw the petition, judges will decide on the matter, but it will be conditional.
Conditional in the sense that you filed a petition and served it on other parties. The parties had to go out of their way to prepare themselves for your petition. Now you have withdrawn it, they have incurred costs. So the condition may be for you to be asked to pay the costs.
Last week, President Museveni, the Electoral Commission, and the Attorney General filed a total of 185 affidavits in response to the 53 grounds raised by NUP lawyers. Oscar Kihika, Museveni's lawyer, says officials will wait for Wine's application.
He's made the announcement. We've heard it. What for us we do as the legal team on the other side is to wait for the application to be filed and served on us as is required by the law.
Wine says the matter will now be presented before what he calls the People's Court, meaning the Court of Public Opinion. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
In Australia, a newspaper has published a third accusation of rape in Australia's parliament. Now, the country's government says it will quickly deliver results of a planned independent inquiry into the parliament's workplace culture. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Australia promised on Monday to provide quick answers in an investigation into their parliament's workplace culture, sparked by internal allegations of sexual assault. Two female workers in Prime Minister Scott Morrison's Liberal Party said last week they had been raped by the same man in 2019 and 2020. The unnamed man is a former Liberal Party worker. Local media reported on Monday a third accusation against him, fueling pressure on the country's leadership. Finance Minister Simon Birmingham is leading the internal inquiry.
Obviously, all of these allegations are incredibly traumatic
just tracing and underpin the crucial work that that needs to be undertaken to give all women, all people, confidence in relation to the processes and procedures that are there to enable and to support them to report such instances such that perpetrators and offenders can be brought to justice.
None of the accusers have formally filed a police complaint, but one, Brittany Higgins, has spoken publicly about her alleged rape and last week said she would file a complaint soon. The third woman, who was unnamed, told local media she had been assaulted in 2016. She said, "I believe his actions constitute sexual assault because he performed or tried to perform sexual acts on me while I was severely intoxicated and unable to provide valid and informed consent." She added the incident happened outside Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, as we've consistently said,
Morrison said he first learned the alleged complaints last week and quickly launched the workplace culture inquiry in response to public outrage.
Thanks to Brian Wood of Reuters for that report. Pope Francis is due to hold an interreligious prayer service at the ancient Mesopotamian site of Ur when he visits Iraq next week. Ur is a sprawling ruin nearly 6,000 years old. Archaeologists hope the Pope's visit will draw renewed attention to the site, as Edward Barron of Reuters reports.
The ancient Mesopotamian site of Ur in Iraq will be the stage for an interreligious prayer service held by Pope Francis next week, an event local archaeologists hope will draw renewed attention to the place revered as the birthplace of Abraham. Popular with Western visitors in the 1970s and 80s, Ur is scarcely visited today after decades of war and political instability shattered Iraq's international tourism industry. The global health crisis has also kept local tourists away. The State Board's Antiquities and Heritage Archaeological Director is Ali Kadim Ghanim.
We're counting on the Pope's visit because it will increase the number of tourists in the city of Ur. Not only tourists, but we believe there will also be more Christians making the pilgrimage.
Located about 200 miles south of the capital, Baghdad, the site is made up of a pyramid-style ziggurat and a residential complex. It was excavated about 100 years ago by Leonard Woolley, a Briton who recovered treasures rivaling those found in Tutankhamun's tomb in Egypt. But little work has since been done on one of the world's oldest cities, a place where urban dwelling, writing, and central state power began. The father of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Abraham, is described in the biblical book of Genesis as having lived in the city. Now it's hoped that the Pope's visit will attract international attention to the site to fund restoration works on its palaces and temples.
That was Edward Barron of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden has called China the United States' most serious competitor and made clear that he is ready to face the challenges China presents.
We'll confront China's economic abuses, counter its aggressive, coercive action to push back on China's attack on human rights, intellectual property, and global governance.
President Biden also said that the United States is ready to engage with China from a position of strength. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a recent CNN television interview that a position of strength means strong alliances. That's a source of advantage for us, not denigrating our alliances, he said. It means showing up again in the world, engaging, because if we don't, China fills in. Secretary Blinken also emphasized that engaging from a position of strength means standing up for our values, not abdicating them when we see the abuse of the rights of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang or democracy in Hong Kong, said Secretary Blinken. It means making sure that we're postured militarily to deter aggression, and it means investing in our own people so that they can compete effectively. In a telephone call between Secretary Blinken and China's top diplomat, Yang Jishu, Mr. Blinken stressed that the United States will continue to stand up for human rights and democratic values in Hong Kong, Tibet, and Xinjiang. He noted that the United States will work with its allies and partners in defense of our shared values and interests to hold the PRC accountable for its efforts to threaten stability in the Indo-Pacific, including across the Taiwan Strait. He also pressed China to join the international community in condemning the military coup in Burma. The president has been very clear that he wants to put and will put and is putting human rights and democracy back at the center of our foreign policy, Secretary Blinken told CNN. And so, whether it's China or any other country where we have deep and serious concerns, this will be something that is front and center.
That was an...